Okay. Well, we continue this morning with our study in the book Money, Possessions, and Eternity by Randy Alcorn. And as Pastor Paul and I are our team teaching it, we're being somewhat selective. But this morning, we're taking up one of the chapters entitled Helping the Poor and Reaching the Lost. And I am convinced that this chapter, this subject, warrants an entire Sunday school class, at least. Why? For two reasons. Because the Bible has a lot to say about the poor, and because we are so disconnected from the reality of poverty. Not something we should despise or beat ourselves up over. God has blessed us. God has sovereignly placed us. You never filled out a questionnaire, did you, before you were born, as to which country you wanted to be born in, as to which parents you wanted? I hope, are you conscious of this often? God, thank you that in your sovereignty, in many of our cases, you've placed me in a Christian home, although that's not universally true. Whatever home you were in, it's by his sovereign good pleasure. But he's placed all of us in, by far, the richest nation on the earth. And a nation that has been blessed, and its soil has been saturated with the gospel, and we have privileges above so many. And so we are really dull when it comes to the whole subject of poverty. And so we need to pray, God, to teach us from your word, sensitize us in an area where we are so isolated, so insulated from those real needs. So it certainly is worthy of our attention. That plus all that the Bible has to say about the poor warrants our careful attention. So we take up this study, Helping the Poor and Reaching the Lost. Let's begin by considering what are some of the causes of poverty. And I have, I think, 10 lines there because I think there are at least close to 10 reasons we can come up with for the causes of poverty. Some are maybe little variations on the theme. In some cases, you might have a scripture to back it up, in which case we welcome that. We always welcome biblical support. What are some of the varied causes of poverty? Michelle.
God.
Okay. God is the first cause. He is the ultimate cause of everything, right? Jesus said, the poor you will always have with you. An interesting statement, isn't it? It seems almost by the ordination of God that there will be always be poor. I didn't put that down. That kind of went without saying, but that is always good to begin with. God is the sovereign distributor of what. He raises up one, puts down another, Psalm 75. So that's a good first answer. What are the other causes of poverty? Diana? Okay, okay.
And then also, isn't it about the adulterer as well?
Okay, yeah. What, Rob?
Proverbs 7, your wealth goes to a foreigner.
Okay, that covers two. And let me just give you quick scriptures on these. Well, some of you can quote this. Proverbs 24, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and your poverty will come in like a robber, your want like an armed man. Laziness. Quickly, Proverbs 10:4, because if you're taking notes, you can jot this down. Clearly, laziness is a cause of poverty for some. Proverbs 10:4, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. General principle. Not always, not in every society, but a general principle. Diligence will bless you with some wealth, and general principle, poverty or laziness will result in poverty. You can look at 2 Thessalonians. Is it 2:10? I have 2:10 down, but is it 3:10? He who will not work, let him not eat. That might have been, I think it's, is it 2:10 or 3:10? 3:10. In my notes, I put that wrong. So, laziness. And then Diana hinted at something else, which is what? Immorality, right? I don't have that text, but But clearly it talks about the man, the young man who gives in to the adulteress, the strange woman. We studied that in our home group. Will come to poverty. He'll be reduced to poverty.
That's a question. Is that poverty of spirit? Because there's a lot of adulterers and a lot of wicked people that are very wealthy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think when you read those passages, you know, chapter 6, chapter 7, you see that there's terrible spiritual consequences. I was almost in ruin in the midst of the congregation. But then you also see that the man is reduced to a loaf of bread, it says in one place. And I always wondered, what does that mean? He's reduced to a loaf of bread. And then I realized, well, it's talking about poverty, because in many cases, you know, it will drain your resources. Definitely your spiritual resources, sometimes your material. And maybe another principle, the more general principle, wasteful self-indulgence, Proverbs 21:17. He who loves pleasure will become a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not become rich. So maybe we just lump that under selfish indulgence will lead to poverty. So not only laziness, but sensual indulgence as well. Rob.
Filled with your wealth and your labors go to the house of a foreigner. It's fairly explicit. You're going to be drained of wealth if you engage in that as a general principle.
Yeah, yeah, very good. So we've hit several reasons, but there are others. Betty, I'll defer to your wife, Mike, right?
I was thinking of corrupt government.
Absolutely, absolutely. Corrupt government. The Bible, especially the Old Testament, talks a lot about oppression and the Proverbs. Many are poor because they've been oppressed by government and by other individuals. We might say injustice, governmental and individual, corporate. That's a good one. Mike?
We think alike.
How about that? Amazing. They independently raised their hands and there was a thought transference between them. Mike, done. Yeah, you know, I didn't have that, but that's good. And what would be the connection? I'm just trying to think offhand.
Mind and body, not only take care of your mind spiritually, but also take care of your body.
Yeah, and so you're thinking of the medical expenses or that come with remedying physical situations. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I don't have that down, but I think that's very, very true. I'll defer to Amber.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I was going to say the same.
Yeah, look at this. We have these wonderful marriages going on here that these husbands and wives are thinking alike. Who will be next as a husband-wife pair? Now, you're going to think Clarice. But let's work with this for just a moment. Natural disasters, for example, and we're not at a loss for modern examples, such as the tsunami in Indonesia and typhoon in Philippines, hurricanes, Hurricane Katrina, floods. Earthquakes, natural disasters, which seem to be multiplying. And okay, Barry and Clara.
I was just going to say, similar to what Mike said, illness, like beggars that laid by the king's gate, they're not able to work. So they're...
Yeah, yeah. So physical problems, not even for which people are necessarily responsible, but afflictions, and that comes with maybe oppression, not people not caring for them. Much more in ancient society, right? When we see Jesus healing people, they were desperately dependent, and you know, we have all kinds of structures now to support. But yeah, there are physical maladies that are not due to their own guilt. Barry, and then Steve.
Addictions. I did a lot of work in the prisons over my years. Heard the stories of these guys. I mean, I'm talking about businessmen and very done very well, lost their wives, their families,
yeah,
businesses, and wind up in jail because they're addicted to whatever.
Yeah. Addictions, not only because of the cost of feeding the addiction, but also because it leads to crime, and it puts everything else on hold. You know, when you're addicted, you're consumed with feeding that addiction, and you're not being productive in other areas. You know, the addicted person life kind of stops, maturity-wise, in so many ways, when that addiction comes on, because it's all about feeding the addiction. So that will lead to poverty. Steve.
Mismanagement of wealth.
Yes, mismanagement of wealth. Boy, there are some nuances here I did not have down, and the author did not either. Mismanagement of wealth. We sometimes hear of, you know, professional athletes, people come out of the ghetto and they get all of a sudden multi-million dollars, but they don't know how to handle that, and or maybe they, you know, they invest it wrongly and it gets mismanaged and they come to poverty. Yeah, good. Jeff? Yeah. Throw that in with catastrophes, natural catastrophes. Rob?
On the mismanagement of wealth, I just want to point out two sides there. One is greed for gain and fear of loss is the other.
Mm.
You know, it's two ditches people can fall into.
Yeah, okay, very good.
Speaking of, perhaps more neutral would be the economic conditions of a particular nation.
Yes.
India, Bangladesh, Philippines.
Yeah.
Again, the sovereignty of God for some born into those situations is going to be poor.
Yeah. Yeah, and that hits on, I think, what we were missing, what the author talks about, adverse climate, you know, insufficient natural resources. I worked with the Cambodians in Philadelphia, and they were blessed with a land that was very rich and fertile. The Cambodians were very easygoing, very slow-moving, and you wonder what contributes to the temperament of a people. Part of it is their environment, their climate and their environment. The climate was very hot, and they didn't have to work all that hard to get resources, you know, from the soil, and they were just very slow, easygoing, and it was determined in part from that. So, yes, some lands are more barren and some are more fertile, natural resources. And then just throw in the pot there, maybe the lack of, they may have a rich soil, but they lack the technology to get those minerals, those resources out of the earth. That would factor in as well. Okay, I think we've covered the range pretty well. Now, my next question is, what is one of the significant implications of this variety? We've seen there's a diversity of causes of poverty, everything from culpable things, you know, you're being lazy, you're being indulgent, you're being sinful, to things for which people are not personally responsible. They are, in a real sense, victims. How does this, well, what is one of the big implications of that variety? Mike?
The fall.
Oh, well, that's the cause of all of it, right? But in terms of the implication, where we go from here?
You have to be extremely cautious about jumping to a moral conclusion.
That's good. Yeah, that's a very good insight, isn't it? Boy, that we need to learn that. He who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him. So you don't conclude you're poor, you must be lazy. No, it's helpful to understand the diversity so that we suspend judgment. But then another implication, Beth.
The way that you
help. Exactly. The sources imply different causes, imply different remedies, different cures. So let's quickly just survey the field and let's go through some of these. If it's insufficient natural resources, adverse climate, like Pastor Chuck was talking about, what do we do? How do we help? Sandy? Yeah. It would be good if David Rothbard was here. We need to pray for him as he's in Paris, but he would have much to say on this. But maybe find alternative means for the economy, right? What has God given you? God says to Moses, what's in your hand, Moses? You know, use what you have and do what you can. And that's true nationally, too. So if they don't have certain resources, perhaps they have other resources, and perhaps to come in and help such people to redirect their energies into a productive economy. If there's geography is not the issue, if there's a good climate and there are many natural resources and minerals, but they lack the skill, the technology to develop it, to mine it, the answer would be what? Rather obvious?
Training,
teach, yeah, help them to. And Chuck, you, at some point, speak to Mike and Nancy Worthing and what they're doing in Haiti. What would that relate to?
Well, I think it's bringing people into for training, practical issues. There's a peanut farm there, and trying to get some of the fabric of the economy back in place. I guess also in Africa, some of us saw it firsthand. Ron was there with me. I'm not sure about David Rothbard. We helped the people plant pineapples, and that's still prospering. And it has this little village called Kisega. Just by planting pineapples, they were successful in moving forward.
Okay. So sometimes we help by giving know-how and skill and technology to help people in impoverished countries. If it's a case of oppression and exploitation, what's the remedy? Injustice? We try to bring justice, right? And if we've got godly people in government, and contrary to the Mennonites and the Plain community, we believe that there is a place for godly people in government. You know, Joseph was there, and others were raised up to be in places of public influence. We need to pray for righteous rulers, right, to try to undo the corruption. We fight for justice, and at whatever personal level we can do that. Perhaps it doesn't often touch us, but we need to be a voice for justice. Now, some churches, that's all they're about is social justice because they've got no gospel. Well, we've got a gospel that is primary, but that doesn't mean we're not concerned about justice, right? That is a coordinate concern. When there's been a natural disaster, a catastrophe, a typhoon, an earthquake, a flood, what do Christians do?
Relief efforts, but hopefully relief efforts that build some ongoing structure.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Long-term, we obviously bring the gospel as well, but how many Christians have gone down to New Orleans and worked, you know, for Hurricane Katrina years after the disaster? I would say a large majority were probably Christians. I don't have stats on that, but knowing, you know, how Christians respond to that, you know, we're going to rebuild the house, and we're going to just help with the long-term remedy in view. When it comes to the sinful causes of poverty, laziness, and indulgence, what's the solution?
The gospel.
People have to get saved and have their hearts changed. Okay, so that surveys the field, gives us a sense of the breadth of causes and remedies. Now, what is our responsibility to the poor? Here, we're going to look at Scripture, so I ask for volunteers, men and ladies. I'd like to hear both voices. The Bible throughout expresses a concern, God's concern for the poor and provisions he's made for the poor. Let's begin with the law. Leviticus 19, 9 and 10. Volunteer. Pete. Deuteronomy 5, 15, 7 to 11. Tyrese. Proverbs 19. Somebody take those three Proverbs. Murray. Can flip those pages quickly. And I included the Proverbs because the Proverbs basically are based on the Mosaic Law. Leviticus 19, 9 and 10.
When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. And you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God.
Okay. Somebody put that in modern terminology. What is God saying through the law? leave some behind for the poor. Don't deliberately, you know, glean everything, but leave something on the edges for the poor. And then Deuteronomy 15. 11.
If there is among you a poor man of your brother within any of the gates in your land, which the Lord your God will give you, you shall not harden your heart, nor shut your hand from your poor brother, but you shall open your hand wide to him, and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand. Your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing. Cry out to the Lord against you, may become sin among you. You shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your works, and all to which you put your hand. For the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother, your poor, and your needy.
Jesus must have had that in mind when he said, you always have the poor with you. The poor will never cease from your land. You know that the seventh year in Israel was the sabbatical year when debts were remitted. So here, somebody borrows something from you in the sixth year, right? You might be hesitant to say, wait a minute, he's going to get it back in a year. And he says, don't do this with grief. The Old Testament teaches a lot about the New Testament. Sometimes we make too much of a disjunction, but the Old Testament is concerned not only that you do, but how you do. You know how it says God loves a cheerful giver. He doesn't want you to give with grief, with sadness, grudgingly. Well, that was true of the Old Testament. Well, you know, he's going to get a, you know, the sabbatical year is coming up in a year. Don't do it with grief. Don't give with grief. And so lend generously and lend cheerfully to the poor. And then the Proverbs, just a smattering of all that the Proverbs has to say.
Proverbs 19:17. He who has pity on the poor lends to the Lord, and he will pay back what he has given. We'll pause between or just go?
Just go, yeah.
Proverbs 22:9. He who has a generous eye will be blessed. He who gives of his bread to the poor. 28:27. He who gives to the poor will not lack, and he who hides his eyes will have many curses.
Just a smattering of the verses in the book of Proverbs promising that God is going to take care of you if you take care of the poor. You lend to the poor, you're lending to the Lord. You're generous to the poor, you'll be blessed. You give to the poor, and you yourself will never want. That's just a sampling of the Proverbs. And we could state it states it negatively too. Watch out. If you rob the poor, you oppress the poor, God is going to take it personally. You're doing that to him. And if you're giving to the poor, you're doing it to him. And so the Proverbs are replete with promises to the generous and threats to the oppressive. Now, the book of Proverbs, volunteer for Isaiah 58. Sandy, yeah. This is perhaps one of the more eloquent ones. Listen to the heart of God speaking through the prophet to his apostate people who have turned away from God's heart and God's law, and yet they were very religious. They were very formalistically religious. They were going through the motions, but listen to the heart of God.
Is not this the fact that I chose to choose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the straps of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house when you see the naked, to cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Then shall your light break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry, and you will say, here I am. If you take away the yoke from your midst, the pointing of the finger and speaking wickedness, if you pour yourself out to the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in the darkness, and your gloom be as the noonday, and the Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your desire in scorched places and make your bones strong. And you shall be like a water garden, like a spring of water, whose waters do not fail. And your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt, and you shall raise up the foundations of many generations. And you shall be called the repairer of all griefs, the restorer of griefs to dwell in.
Great. In a nutshell, Sandy, what is God saying to his religious people?
In a nutshell. Be real and you will be blessed.
He didn't want the formalistic ceremonial religion. He said, you want to practice true religion, you know, this is the fast that I choose. You know, share your food with the hungry, divide your bread with the hungry, bring in the homeless poor, show it by your actions. In this case, very horizontally, very socially. You know, otherwise, all the vertical is pretense. If you say you love God, but you don't manifestly love your brother, then, as John says, you're a liar. Okay, now in the Gospels, and I don't want to get bogged down. Let's turn to Matthew 25. I think it's a familiar passage. And here Jesus is picturing the final judgment when he returns. And he puts his sheep on the right and the goats on the left. And what does he say to them? I'll pick up at verse 34, then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Here are the people that go to heaven. He's going to describe the people that are welcomed into the heavenly kingdom. Who are they? For I was hungry, Jesus said, and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him. There's a beautiful unself-consciousness here about the believer. Take note of this. The believer isn't one who's, you know, keeping a tally. Huh? I did this good work. Because the believer isn't working with this score sheet. Well, you know, my good works have to outweigh my bad. So I know I've done a lot of bad things for which I feel guilty. But here's a good one. You know, and he's unself-conscious. You live out of that new heart unself-consciously. And that's a beautiful thing because it's natural to you because there's a new nature. And so the righteous says, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you to drink? And when did we see you a stranger and invite you in or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you, the king? And that is Jesus will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least, you did it to me. And then he goes on and speaks the converse. Those who do not feed the hungry, do not visit the sick and the imprisoned, etc. And they're the ones who are the goats, and they go into eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. But here's the positive. Now, do we take from this, to get to heaven, I need to do these good deeds. I need to earn my way to heaven by, you know, paying heed to the homeless and the hungry and the imprisoned, the incarcerated. Is that what it's saying? Clearly not. From the whole Bible, salvation is by grace through faith. It's not of yourselves. It is the gift of God. It is not a result of works. But what is he saying? In characterizing the heaven-bound this way, what is he saying? Pastor Paul, what is he saying?
I think he's saying this is what real Christianity looks like. This is what you're doing. You're serving other people. You have real faith. And this is what it looks like.
Yeah. This is characteristic of my people. They will do this. They will care. And in doing so, they will really do it to Jesus because Jesus identifies with his people, even the least. And I don't know how... who is considered the least. But if there is such a category as least, maybe those who are most marginalized and least esteemed by the world, they're Jesus' brethren, you do it to them, you do it to him. And then we have in Luke 4, you know, when he's preaching in the synagogue in Nazareth, God has anointed me, I just preached on that from Isaiah 61, to preach the gospel to the poor in particular. And then in Luke 10, I won't read it for the sake of time because we know it well, But that's the story of the Good Samaritan. And what is being heralded, what is being touted there? Well, primarily, the message is it's a strike against Israel's nationalistic pride, isn't it? The real zinger is that it was a Samaritan who did that. We mustn't miss that. It was the Samaritan, not the religious Jews crossed the street. It was a Samaritan. How did the Jews view the Samaritans? They were dogs. They were half-breeds. They were hated. They walked around Samaria, not through it. And so Jesus made the hero of the story a Samaritan. That was the real zinger. He was attacking Jewish nationalistic pride and self-righteousness. But even though that's the main thrust, the fact is the Samaritan is heralded because he did something that's praiseworthy. What did he do? Somebody, we know the story well. Somebody recount. What did he do? He showed compassion and he took the man, the wounded man, put him on his donkey, paid for his expenses, bound him up. He cared for a man who was afflicted, who was very needy. And even though there was an added social, cultural dimension to it, Jesus is saying this man did a good thing because that's what God's people do. When they see, who is my neighbor then? And that's the question that prompted it. Who is my neighbor? And how would we answer that according to the parable? My neighbor is a Jewish guy between Jericho and Jerusalem. Well, I'm not likely to meet one of those.
Person you run into.
Anybody who is in your path that has a need. That's the upshot, right? Who is my neighbor? Anybody in front of me that has a need of which I am aware and for which I can do something about. That's my neighbor. They were trying to get out of neighbor love. And then turn to Luke 14, 12 to 14. That's worth eyeballing. And he also went on to say to the one who had invited him, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors. Otherwise, they may also invite you in return, and that will be your repayment. But when you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, since they do not have the means to repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. How many of us do that? Now, that doesn't mean you can't have family for Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner. It's not precluding having your family, your friends. You know, we treasure times with family. But is there ever a time when you invite the likes of those to your table, into your home? That's one of the things that might hit us between the eyes. And we have to ask, you know, do we have this kind of people in our home? That's challenging. David Rothbard preached on Luke 16, the rich man in hell. What characterized the rich man? He didn't care for the poor. And was that why he went to hell? No. Because there are many philanthropic people who care for the poor, and they're going to hell too. But it was a manifestation of the fact that he cared nothing for God, because he cared nothing for the image bearer of God that was, you know, eating the crumbs that fell from his table. So it's evidence of the fact that he didn't know God. He didn't know God who made man in his own image, so as to have compassion and mercy on an image bearer of God, a fellow image bearer of God. And that's just one of the evidences that he didn't know God. And then Jesus gave to the poor. Look at John 13, 29. Little verses that get tucked away, and sometimes we miss the point, easy to do. In John 13 and 29, for some were supposing, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus was saying to him, well, let's back up. Jesus said to Judas, what you do, do quickly, knowing that Judas was going to betray him. And some were supposing, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus was saying to him, buy the things we have need of for the feast, or else that he should give something to the poor. That's one of those verses we read in passing, but what does it say about Jesus? Some thought, oh, when Jesus told Judas, do quickly, he's either sending him out to get provisions for the Passover feast, or what? Give something to the poor. What does that tell us about Jesus?
Cared about the poor.
He was in the habit of giving to the poor, right? Jesus had no place to lay his head. Foxes have holes, birds have nests. He had no place to lay his head, but Jesus gave to the poor. And I miss that, but glad for it being pointed out. Now, what about the early church? How did the early church regard the poor? Well, very quickly, in passing, but again, significant. Little words, little verses. We need to read our Bibles carefully and often take note of words and phrases and make them our meditation. Dorcas. In Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha, which translated in Greek is called Dorcas. This woman was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did. She is heralded as a woman who was charitable. Now, who are you charitable toward? People who need charity, the poor. Did you notice this about Cornelius in Acts chapter 10, just one chapter later? Cornelius, the Gentile soldier who ended up getting converted under Peter's preaching. It says in Acts 10, 2, he was a devout man, one who feared God with all his household. He gave many alms to the Jewish people and prayed to God continually. Alms are gifts of charity. He was seeking God. That's why the Lord, you know, sent Peter to him to get the rest of the message, because he was a God-fearing man. And one of the evidences of it was that he was charitable. He was giving alms. He was giving to the poor. And then 1 John 3:16, if anyone has this world, I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. In Acts 11, the early church, and again, we saw last week that it was an abnormal situation. But what did the early church do? At this time, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch, one of them named Agabus. Agabus predicted that there would be a famine. And verse 29, in the proportion that any of the disciples had means, each of them determined to send a contribution for the relief of the brethren living in Judea. And they did so, sending it in charge of Barnabas and Saul to the elders. Brothers were suffering famine in Judea. And so there was a contribution by other Christians, other churches, to alleviate that need. What about the epistles? Is it significant that when Paul in Galatians 2 finally connects with the other apostles in Jerusalem and they were comparing notes and they found out we're preaching the same gospel, Paul uses that in Galatians as an argument to validate his gospel. Hey, the gospel I'm preaching is the same one preached by the men who knew Jesus in the flesh. We don't have a different message. The only thing they asked me to do is to remember the poor. They had no additions, no corrections of Paul's gospel, but they said, Paul, make sure that in your travels among the Gentiles, you remember the poor. And then he adds, the very thing I was eager to do. They reminded me, but they didn't have to tell me because I was already eager to do it. And then in James 1, what is true religion? Somebody quote, what is true religion according to James 1:27? True religion is, say it out loud, visit widows and orphans in their affliction, right? Keep oneself unstained from the world. And in James 2, show your faith by your works. In 1 John 3:16, if anyone sees his brother and has this world's goods, and sees his brother in need, and what? I'm losing it. Holds it. How does the love of God dwell in him? Right? Did I say that is 3:16? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, it's 17. Whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? That's really verse 17. Now, let's turn over the page, if that's how you have it. Let's consider the scriptural priority in giving to the poor. We see it's a tremendous concern from Old Testament to New Testament to give to the poor, to help the poor. But there is a distinct priority. What is that priority? Galatians 6:10. Anybody know it, Murray?
First to the household of faith.
Yes. Galatians 6:10, as a canopy verse, do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. And I remember sometimes there are people who will press upon us, you know, to give to the poor generally, and they'll fail to make this distinction. But when you look at the passages, some of which we've considered, notice the emphasis. Jesus says that if the person's hungry, you feed him. If he's in prison, you visited me, etc. If he was naked, you clothed me, you clothed him. Who did you do it to? To one of the least of these, my brethren. Not everybody is a brother or sister of Jesus. Believers are. So there's a priority of concern for fellow believers. In Acts 11:29, the famine relief fund was for whom? The church, saints in Judea. In James 2:14, he says, if your brother or sister is naked and destitute, don't say to him, be warmed and filled, without giving him brother or sister. And we know that brother or sister has a distinctive meaning. It's a redemptive term. Yes, we are a brotherhood of humanity, and occasionally God is called the father of all humanity, but overwhelmingly, especially in the New Testament, brother and sister means brother in Christ, sister in Christ, not just fellow image bearer of God. And 1 John 3:17, which we just quoted, if any of you have this world's goods and see your brother has a need and shuts up his heart from him. So there's a distinct priority in caring for poor fellow believers. Well, what are wise ways to care for the poor? Let me just paraphrase Deuteronomy 14, which we didn't read. It basically says there is a third-year tithe. Pastor Paul made reference to this. As you try to figure out the tithing under the Old Covenant, there are two annual tithes, and there's a third-year tithe, and it was for the alien, the widow, and the orphan. So there was a special offering in Old Covenant Israel taken for the alien, the widow, the orphan, those who were needy and poor, bereft. In Luke 19, Leviticus 19, that's the passage that says, leave some gleanings for the needy and the stranger. And then turn to Exodus 23. And I'll read 3, 6, and 9. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. Verse 3. Verse 6, you shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. Verse 9, you shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. He calls his people to not show partiality toward the poor. New Covenant examples, this is rehearsing what we've already seen. Matthew 25, you feed, you clothe, you visit, you invite. Luke 14, invite the